Thank you to Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Tracy Hall is a mother, author, speaker, business marketing expert, and victim of financial and intimate fraud from Australia. After a series of traumatic events and life changes, Tracy found herself unexpectedly single in her early 40s. Although she had a full life, she sought an activity partner to grow with. That's when she met Max Tavita, a Bondi Beach businessman with an active lifestyle and a deepening love for Tracy. Over the next year and a half, he would carefully cultivate a relationship that promised to fulfill all of Tracy's romantic, personal, and even financial dreams. However, it would all come toppling down upon his December 2017 arrest, which brought the realization that Max, whose real name was Hamish, wasn't who he said he was. Since navigating a long criminal justice process and sharing her story via podcast, book, and beyond, Tracy has made it her mission to bring awareness to the intricacies and stigmas of intimate fraud. The Broken Cycle Media team is immensely grateful for Tracy's openness, expertise, and advocacy in the following two episodes.
My name is Tracy Hall. These days, I am an author, a speaker, an educator, and an advocate for victims of scams and fraud, particularly intimate fraud. But prior to that, I spent 25 years in corporate marketing, mostly working for US-based tech companies. That was my career before a significant life event changed what I do for a living. I'm a child of the 70s, middle-class Australia. I had a very stable nuclear family, I guess you could say, if you had to describe it. I have two brothers. I am the middle girl within a boy household. It's fair to say if I couldn't learn how to catch a football, then I didn't have a place in our family. So I learned very quickly, very early on, how to sort of engage in that way. So grew up in a very active environment. Mum and dad put us through a great education. And we had a pretty simple upbringing, just involved a lot of sport, summer camping trips, lots of time at the beach. Very idyllic Australian kind of upbringing. I traveled for a few years after school. I put a backpack on my back. A lot of Australians do this. And I went over to Europe for a few years and just got some life experience. I imagine my parents were quietly nervous because I'd been to New Zealand, but I really hadn't traveled anywhere else. We weren't a family that could afford international travel back in the 80s. In the lead up to leaving, I worked three jobs to earn the money to do it. I did some incredible trips and met some amazing people. And honestly, it was the best thing I could have done. I don't think you ever get rid of that travel bug once you've got it. So even now, I will forgo coffee for a year so that I have enough money to go on a trip. That's how passionate I am about traveling. I came back to Australia. I started university. I was focused. I was buttoned down. I was ready to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And then came back to study sports science. I did a degree in sports science. And then I moved to Sydney. Straight after that, I got a job working for the Olympic Stadium. It was 1998, right before the 2000 Olympics. I secured this amazing job with this company down in Sydney running the stadium for the Olympics. And that was just my entry level into corporate world. Then sort of quickly moved on after the Olympics. There weren't really that many jobs in sport in Sydney. There were a lot of people looking in that field. And I ended up going into finance. I worked for a hedge fund. I worked for telecommunications. I did take a gap year in my late 20s after my dad died. He died very suddenly. And then I had a friend who also died very suddenly. And suddenly work didn't seem as important as it once did. So I ran away to India for a year, as you do. I worked in an orphanage in Nepal and in a school in India for a year. And then finally, I ended up in tech, working for lots and lots of big US tech companies, always in marketing and really just on the cutting edge of marketing and technology, apps and all of that kind of thing, which I just absolutely loved. I got married in my early 30s. I had my child, my daughter, when I was almost 35. Then I found myself separated and divorced at 40. I don't think anyone goes into a marriage thinking that that's how it's going to end up. So I was shaken. It was not how I wanted my future to roll out. I wanted more children. Also, within my marriage, I'd had a miscarriage, so I had lost a child. It came at a time where I guess I had reconciled that within myself, but I still felt incredibly sad that my future was not going to be what I thought it was. I wasn't going to have that family unit that I grew up in and that I so desperately wanted. By this stage, I had some time to get my head around single parenting, working full time, and my new normal. Anybody in those first few years after a separation and a family breakdown, you're relatively vulnerable. You are emotional at times, but as with all things in life, we have to accept and move on. And that's what I was doing at this point in my life. I'm a pretty optimistic person. And I said to myself, you know what? I have the whole second half of my life to look forward to. I was 40 when I got divorced. And I thought, this is halfway. What do I want the second half of my life to look like? I have the ability to rewrite this script now. So I felt really intentional in terms of where I was at. I had had a lot of years of experience, a lot of things had happened. My dad had passed away when I was young. I had miscarried a child. My mum got breast cancer not long after my daughter was born. It's just a big lasagna of emotions, I think it's fair to say. Probably a year after my husband and I had separated, I had spent that year getting myself together and getting my head around this new normal. It was around that time where I thought, I would like to spend some time with someone on the weekends doing the things that I loved. I wasn't in a headspace where I thought, I want to find another husband or I'm going to have more children. I don't want to be swept off my feet. I just simply want to meet somebody who has similar values and interests to me. When I got married and when I met my ex-husband, dating apps weren't a thing. You met people through friends or through work or through going out. Here I am at 40. Home every night with a child and working really hard. And I thought, where am I going to meet anyone? Like, this is the option that we have now. So went onto the apps and had a bit of a laugh doing that, I guess. It's a bit of a wild ride if you've never done it before. I ended up swiping right on a man by the name of Max Tevita. He was 41. He was a Bondi surfer. He was a chief investment officer for a family office. And we connected and slowly started chatting on the app, back and forth and some banter, which turned into some phone conversations, which eventually turned into a date. And that was quite a number of weeks after we'd first connected because I didn't actually have a lot of time as a single mom working full time to go on dates. So I was quite particular about who I gave that time to, I guess. It was a pretty good date. We went for a meal. He picked me up in the city. He made the reservation. He made all the plans. It was not a long meal. He didn't really drink. It was very wholesome, I guess you could say. We had grown up in a similar era in Australia by the beach. So a lot of our cultural references were very similar. He had a great sense of humor. There was a lot of banter. He was very easy to chat to. It flowed really naturally. It wasn't awkward. He sort of had this very active athletic lifestyle of surfing and paddleboarding and running, all of those kind of outdoor-y active things. And then he had this side of him, which was his corporate world. as a finance executive, and he spoke a lot about that. There was a lot of chit-chat about his work, and because I worked in corporate as well, I understood a lot of that and he understood my world. So on that level, we were very, very aligned. We were having these conversations and I was working on a really, really big project at work. So I was working super, super long hours and I was pretty tired and I yawned in the middle of a conversation and probably could have been seen as offensive, but he just looked at me and he said, "Gosh, you look really tired. Let's get the bill. Let's get you home." He wasn't offended. He just wanted to make sure I was okay. And we went outside and he put me in a taxi and he sent me home. I just thought that was just a really lovely gesture. Like, I felt looked after in that moment. And that's sort of where the relationship began. And we just kept in touch. Where possible, we would go for meals. And that sort of progressed into more of an exclusive, intimate relationship down the line. We just slowly built our relationship over the course of 16 months. There were a lot of discussions about his line of work, global markets and political impacts on the economy. He'd send me pictures from his office, what they ate, different people in his office, what his desk looked like. And because I worked in corporate as well, I understood a lot of that and he understood my world. He was also really interested in me and what I was doing. He was a phenomenal listener. And I guess in retrospect, what that gave him was a vision of what I wanted my future to be. You need to find people's soft spots. You could call them vulnerabilities, but the cracks in the armor that these types of people weaponize. You can do that by asking incredible questions. You can do that by listening. You can do that by mirroring back. Very rarely does coercion and control and abuse like this come marching in holding a big red flag. It comes into your world slowly and insidiously, and it's disguised as care, as concern, as listening, as love, as let me help you. So Max, he was just so good at weaponizing those behaviors to get what he wanted, to then manipulate those into things that he could use against me. Of course, I didn't know this at the time. He was just a great listener. He mirrored back to me exactly what I said I wanted for my life and the kind of partner I wanted, the future that I wanted. And this is a cognitive bias that we have. Like, we have this similarity bias. And that is essentially, if someone looks like you, they sound like you, they have the same values and morals as you, they present themselves in a similar way to you, then you are more likely to love them, to trust them, to do what they say. And that's exactly what he did. He just mirrored back to me what I said I wanted. And of course I fell in love with him. Of course I thought that was just the most amazing relationship I'd ever been in. Because I told him exactly what I wanted and he gave me that. It's very coercive and you just don't realize these things are happening until you look backward. You can only connect the dots in reverse. And at the time, I just felt nothing but loved. Those months leading up to the end were very, very much about trips together. He met my family. We went on a holiday where my mom and my daughter came. There was so much vision for the future and our plans, the way we spoke about the future. And whilst we didn't live together, whilst we didn't have lots and lots of day-to-day time together, the conversations were very deep. He was just very supportive, very future-focused. He was my biggest fan. He was the one that was always pumping my tires, saying, "Tracy, you are so good at what you do. You are the hardest working person I have ever met. You deserve to be financially independent. Let me help you." And I think when you're in a relationship and you've got someone who is supporting you on that level, as well as listening, as well as planning for the future, it all seems to be lining up. In the last 6 months of the relationship, he was talking to me a lot about what we in Australia call our superannuation, which is like your 401k. It is your retirement savings. So every month when you get paid, a portion of your salary goes into a fund that is to be put away for your retirement that you don't get access to until you're 65. I had 22 years of career savings in my retirement fund. In Australia, most of those funds are regulated funds. They go into a big fund. It's managed by a superannuation company. There's a lot of regulation around it and it's very secure. But there is one option that we have here where you can actually self-manage your superannuation or your 401k. There are rules around it. You have to have a constitution. You have to have director's rights. You need legal documents. There's quite a lot you need to go through to have a self-managed superannuation fund. Over the time, he had essentially convinced, groomed, and guided me to set up a self-managed super fund. And because of the way he had positioned himself over the last 15, 16 months as a very high-level, knowledgeable, and successful finance executive for a family office. So he was managing some of the richest families in Australia, their family wealth. And he was the investment officer for that. So putting together the investment strategies and making all those trades. He had Bloomberg monitors in his lounge room that he was doing trades on all the time. He had people in his back office that he would talk to and ask them to execute trades. I met his CEO. There were reports and documents that he would send me every week that he had sent out to his family office clients. There was just hundreds of conversations about this. So it was this whole movie is how I describe it, that he set up to have me believe he was this very high-level finance executive. So by the time he said to me, "Trace, you are the hardest working person I know. You should be financially independent. I could manage your money in a self-managed super fund in the way that I do it for my family office clients. That would mean that your retirement, your future would be very, very financially stable." By that stage, I had had so many pieces of information presented to me over the year that confirmed that everything he said was true. It all lined up to the point where I had not one shadow of a doubt that he was the best person to invest my life savings. So he groomed and guided me through that process, which is quite a legal process to get your money out of these regulated funds into a self-managed super fund. Everything was in my name. The documents were all legitimate. Everything was correct. I believed I'd done everything right. So off we went and he was investing. He showed me reports for what was happening with my money, with my trades, because I'd ask him for them. And he would present those to me. There'd be pages and pages of documentation on letterhead from the investment trading firm. So I believed everything was okay. At the time, I actually just felt supported by him. In the same way, if I have a friend who has a small business and they say to me, "I really need to think about some marketing activities and my marketing strategy. I've spent 25 years in marketing, so I've got a pretty strong opinion and I'm going to give them advice. I might even write them up a document. I'll send them some links. I'll give them all the information they need." And this is how it was with him, because he had presented himself as a finance professional. And I believed he loved me, and I believed that we were building a future together. I had not one reason to doubt him. Certainly, I felt like everything was heading in the right direction. I was genuinely happy and excited about my future. And then it all came crashing down. The weekend before Max got arrested, we took a trip up to Byron Bay, which is this idyllic little coastal town about 10 hours north of Sydney. And I was up there speaking at a women's conference. That weekend, we looked at properties to buy. We were talking to real estate agents. We were talking about what the next 10 years of our life looked like. We were planning holidays. We just had a beautiful weekend. And I missed a call from him, and I spent the rest of the day trying to get back in touch. By the time that night rolled around, I was pretty worried because it was very, very unusual for us not to be in constant contact, whether that was text or WhatsApp or FaceTime. That night rolled around, I hadn't heard from him. I was so frantic about the situation that I called Bondi Police and I asked them to do a wellness check on him because I just knew something was wrong. And they were sort of saying things like, "What's his name? What's his age? How is his mental health?" I said, "Everything's fine. We've just been to Byron Bay. I'm just worried. Maybe there's been an accident or something." So they were off sort of investigating that for me. And I received a call from a girlfriend of mine. It was pretty early in the morning. And she said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm absolutely exhausted. I haven't slept a wink. Something's wrong. Something's happened to Max. I don't know what's happened, but something's wrong." She took a deep breath and she said, "Trace, I'm going to send you a link to a news article, you're going to open it and you're going to call me straight back. And immediately I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's been some news report. There's been a surfing accident, a shark attack. And I said to her, he's dead, isn't he? He's dead. And she said, no, Trace, he's not dead. Just open the link and call me back. I opened the link and it was a Crime Stoppers video of him being arrested outside of his apartment. And his face was blurred out. But of course, I knew without a shadow of a doubt that it was him. And the headlines that were accompanying the article were things like Bondi businessman, 47, superannuation fraud. And in my head, I just couldn't put it together. I was in absolute shock and disbelief. I was probably in denial. And I'm looking at this headline and I'm thinking, they've made a mistake. They've got the wrong person because Max is only 42. The headline didn't match his age. So I shut that down. I called back Bondi police and I said, he's not dead. He's been arrested. And they said, yes, we have just discovered that as well. But just to let you know that the name of the person that lives at that address, his age, his identity, everything you told us about him is not the man that lives at that address. It's not him. And I said, yes, it is. I've just spent the last 16 months of my life with that man. And they said, no, it's not his name. And I said, well, what is his name? They said, we can't tell you. I then contact the detectives who had arrested him. And in between all of that, I received a text back from his brother-in-law, who I had met. I'd left some messages for him overnight because I was incredibly worried. And he wrote a text back to me, which I received just after that call. And it said, Tracy, please call me back on this number urgently, Chris. And in brackets, he had written Hamish's brother-in-law. And I called him straight away and I said, Chris, who the fuck is Hamish? Because that is the first time I had heard his name. I knew him as Max Tevita. The police hadn't told me his name. They just said it wasn't who I said it was. The first time I heard his name, that is when everything started to unravel. I then had to go and spend some significant time with the detectives. They told me his real name, and armed with his real name, I could look at the very, very long history on the internet about the life and crimes that he had committed over the past 30 years. And it turns out that he is one of Australia's most prolific con men. And he had been arrested for swindling 15 Australian victims out of $7.6 million. And I was his last victim. I was just in disbelief. You know that moment where your stomach drops? I couldn't feel my legs. My arms went numb. I felt sick to my stomach. My brain couldn't keep up. I was pretty discombobulated because I'm trying to comprehend a world where this man had been lying beside me for nearly 18 months. We were looking at properties to buy together. We were talking about our future. I was completely in love and having a conversation at the same time with detectives saying, he is a criminal. He has stolen this much money. He will be going to jail and he won't be coming out. You probably will never see your money again. And this is who you're dealing with. These two things just didn't compute. I can't even describe how it felt. I was so confused. I had a six-year-old at home that I was single parenting who had no idea what was going on. She was too young to understand any of this and I didn't want to scare her. I didn't want her to be worried. So I carried on as if nothing had happened. And I had this huge job. I was completely wiped out financially. I had nothing apart from my job, which gave me a monthly income. It was my only financial lifeline. And so I became really scared of losing it. And so I just doubled down. I worked harder than I've ever worked before. And to be honest, it was probably a great distraction. It was a great way for me to cope during those times. Because if I didn't have that and I didn't have my daughter, I would hate to say what would have happened. I was dealing with the police for 3 weeks in terms of getting my statement together. I had to untangle almost 18 months of my life. Every text message, every email, every phone call, every conversation, every memory, every glance, every handhold, every date, everything I had to present to them for my statement and reverse engineer, essentially. I was dealing with the ATO, our Australian Taxation Office. There might have been a tax return that was non-compliant because he had helped me with it. So it was probably likely to be in some way fraudulent. I had a retirement fund that had $0 in it. I was trying to figure what I needed to do with it. I'd never had to do that before, so I was working with authorities on that. Most people who lose money to scams and fraud will never see their perpetrators come to justice. They will never go through a legal system. Quite often law enforcement see it as a civil case and they'll turn you away. They will say, look, this is a civil matter. You freely gave that person money. It's just a bad business deal, is what it's seen as. So in some ways, I consider myself incredibly lucky that it was a criminal case. But what came with that was some difficulties for me to get my head around. So information was very, very vague. There are a lot of victims. It's millions of dollars. We can't tell you where your money went. The financial institutions wouldn't talk to me because it was wrapped up in the criminal case, which lasted 3 years. And Hamish's friends and family wouldn't talk to me either. So there was a huge gap of information that I needed to put this puzzle together in my mind. And I found that really, really difficult to have that hanging over your head. It's exhausting, wondering when the next trial is going to be or the next hearing or the next piece of information. Do they need anything else from me? Am I required to show up? The other thing that happened is that whilst the detectives and law enforcement were investigating the case and pulling everything together, there was an investigative journalist from the Australian newspaper who was introduced to me through a friend of mine. Originally, he was sort of just interested in what had happened to me. I told him, and it took me a long time to meet him. I wasn't ready to have that conversation more broadly. Even some of my closest friends didn't know what had happened. I kept it very, very close. I did meet him in the lead up to the hearing where Hamish was going to plead guilty or not. Greg, who is the journalist, said to me, would you like me to come to that with you? And I said, yes, please. And I had a couple of girlfriends come with me too. I needed that support. And I thought there'd be a lot of people at that hearing. And there wasn't. There was just us. Hamish had to show up. He was in a glass cage with two bodyguards beside him. And that's where we found out that he pled guilty to swindling 15 Australian victims out of $7.6 million. And because he pleaded guilty, none of the victims had to testify, which is good and bad because we never got to do a victim statement. I never got to stand up in front of him and tell him how this has impacted my life. We would have been there for a very long time if every victim stood up and said what they needed to do.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
We pored over this document. It was 33 pages long and it listed out every victim, how much money was lost, what their individual situation was. With that document, Greg said to me, Trace, this is way bigger than just you. And that is where the podcast Who the Hell is Hamish originated from. And that kicked off a year-long investigation by him into the life and crimes of Hamish McLaren, and not just the victims in the Australian case. He went global.
Thank you again to Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, if you like your money and you like good service, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/WCN. That's mintmobile.com/WCN. What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.